You are listening to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. Hello and welcome to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. You know the spiel by now, hopefully, if you've listened before, but we talk to authors about a book that they have enjoyed, that stuck with them through the years, for good reasons and sometimes for bad ones. My name is Chris, known as C.M. Lowry Author. I have read lots of books in my life, and I've written some too. You can find out more about me on Twitter or all the socially places as at C.M. Lowry Author. But we are not here to talk about me. This is the proud moment where we can say hello, Stephen Hart. Welcome to the show.
Hello, welcome.
And you may have come across Stephen from the worlds of RPG with the Oracle RPG magazine, and Xylite, a solo zombie card game.
Yep, I think we've got four versions of it now, so just proves that the zombies just keep on coming.
Yeah, I did see, I saw the one of the recent ones was Xylite Egypt, and like Egypt is a quality place for zombies, and I like the fact that we kind of, you have the mummies thing, but I don't feel zombies get explored enough in a Egypt setting.
Well, it was more than that. I love doing different time periods for the Xylite games. So we have done sort of regular day modern Britain. We've gone to Seattle in America. Then we went back to the Dark Ages. And then we went to 1920 in Egypt, because that's when they were uncovering the tombs.
Yeah.
So the thought of, when would you have a zombie apocalypse? Well, what if the curses were real? What if they triggered something? And, you know, it just seemed to fit. And I love the 1920s and the Art Deco sort of aesthetic. So it was a lovely opportunity to play around with that.
Yeah, I think it's I think the 20s is a really interesting period as well, because like technology is a little bit more limited. And so you can kind of, you know, they sort of had machine guns, but they were a bit rubbish, you know. So like actually a good reliable pistol was still a good thing. Anyway, we're not really here to talk about Xylite either. Stephen, what's brought you to the show?
There's this book I read.
Fantastic. And what book is it?
Blue Moon Rising by Simon R. Green. It's probably not terribly well known. The man has written a lot of books, but he's not an author that seems to come up on, you know, must read lists. He's got a very strong niche fan base, I think, but for some reason hasn't cracked the big sort of scene, even though he is actually a New York Times bestselling author. However, he will admit the only reason he's got that accolade is because he was the author who did the adaptation of Robin Hood.
Yeah, the Kevin Costner one, the Prince of Thieves version.
Correct. And he got the gig because he was a British author who happened to know someone who they needed, or they wanted a British author to write this thing on a reasonable budget, shall we say. And so I was like, sure, I can do that. And he admits, and I've seen it in a couple of interviews, that it actually, the royalties paid off his mortgage. So he's living the life that some of us authors dream of, which is actually paying all the bills through the efforts of what we write on the page. And that's given him the freedom to continue and write his own works, which I think is great. You know, he's not someone who's retired and rested on his laurels. He has, you know, put out several book series, but all of those are to one side. And I think Blue Moon Rising is the first book of his that I read, and it would be the last book of his I would read as well.
And so give us a little sort of potted summary of Blue Moon Rising.
Well, it starts off as a very simple storyline. Prince Rupert is sent out to slay a dragon to prove that he is worthy of at some point being king. Now, that's the storyline. However, the wrinkle is that it's a lie. Everyone expects him to die. He's been sent out to die because by his father, because he's a second son, he's the kingdom is bankrupt. They don't really need him hanging around. And much better if he could just go out there, heroically die. They can write some songs about him and life in the kingdom can carry on. And one of the things I absolutely love is that Rupert knows this. He's absolutely aware of how things are,
That's
but
grim.
he, it's grim, yeah, but he's willing to do it because it's his duty and he's a man of principles. And something that Simon Green does very well, and I was thinking about this when it came to coming on this podcast and talking about a book, why would I pick this book? Why do I love this book, in fact? And fundamentally, it's because of the characters. The characters they're very real, and yet they have, the heroic ones have that heroic touch to them, where even in the face of, it's a bad deal. Your dad has sent you out to die, and yet you're going to do it because it's the right thing to do. And off he trots because the kingdom needs him to do this. And then the plot unfolds from that point. So it's a very simple sort of premise with this nice little twist that everyone, he's aware of. And then things happen from that point on.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's a bit like John dies at the end or something like that, where you've got such a clear idea of where you, well, I mean, in John dies, then you know exactly where the narrative's heading. But having a character who's aware of where their story should end is a different twist on that.
Absolutely. And of course, when he doesn't die on this quest and he returns, it actually creates lots of complications because no one's really expecting that. They weren't expecting his return. How does he do it? How does he then deal with his father? How does the father then deal with him? And there's the whole thing sort of ripples out from there. So that's a good half of why I love the book. But the other thing I love about it is that it's a serious book that has lots of humor in it. It's not a comedy. But it's interesting if when you read the book, there's a lot of parallels with the movie Shrek, because Prince Rupert has a unicorn that he rides, and the unicorn is a bit sassy and sort of talks back to him and that sort of thing. And you look at it now in a post Shrek world, going, this is Shrek, this is that donkey there. And it's not quite to the extent of the Shrek films, which are outright comedies. But you have, there's a scene that was, I think it occurs on page 2. Where they're aware that there is a creature in the woods that they're traveling through, and the prince gets ready, draws his sword, that sort of thing, and he says to the unicorn. In fact, I can read the extract here. Unicorn, he said quietly, peering into the shadows where he'd last seen the demon. You'd better find a tree to hide behind and stay clear of the fight. Don't want you getting hurt. I'm way ahead of you, said the muffled voice. Rupert glanced round to find the unicorn hiding behind a thick bald tree some distance away. Thanks a lot, said Rupert. What if I needed your help? Then you've got a problem, the unicorn said firmly, because I'm not moving. I know a demon when I smell one. They eat unicorns, you know. Demons eat anything, said Rupert. Precisely, said the unicorn, and ducked back out of sight behind this tree. And I just love that. Now, I'm sure my rendition isn't making that particularly funny, but I love it, because if I was the unicorn, I'd be right there with it. Like, yeah, I'm backing out of this. I'm not getting involved in this. If I was Rupert, I wouldn't want my mount to get hurt. I'd be like, okay, go, look after yourself. But the fact that he's already done it before I tell him to do that, I'd be like, whoa, boy, we were supposed to be a team. Come
yeah,
on.
I was watching How I Met Your Mother last night, which is not high literary fare, but there's a bit where someone goes on a date and the date doesn't go very well, and as they're analysing it afterwards, they realise it was that his date didn't engage in the check dance, which is where you she pretends to want to pay and then
for the check. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And that's the same thing there. You're fine with the unicorn hiding behind the tree, but it's the bit where they don't even attempt to be part of the battle with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's so real as well, because you can see yourself, you can see both points of view of that. And I think that's really good. And again, then you have the character pieces. The characters of his stories are so good. Now, there's things you can criticize about Simon Green's work. And I'm on record for doing so. I've published reviews of his work, and I've said where I feel like there are flaws. But his characters are real, and that's the thing that I absolutely love. Another example is that quite shortly after, and all of this occurs in the first chapter, so I'm not giving spoilers away here, but he's off, he needs to go and He's on this quest to go and kill a dragon, but the problem is nobody knows where the dragons are anymore because they've all been wiped out in ancient times. There is a belief that there's one left, but where they are isn't known. So he's off to see the Night Witch. Now, the Night Witch lives in this hut inside a dark forest, and the forest is very sort of Hansel and Gretel. It's that kind of it's got that kind of vibe to it. And she's supposed to be a temptress of men. She used to seduce them and then, you know, drain their blood, that type of thing. There's all these myths about her. And when he gets to her, actually, she's just this sad old woman. She's a sad old woman living alone who once fell in love with someone who spurned her because she did bathe in the blood of virgins, and he was the king at the time, and he obviously that's a bit of a deal from a relationship.
I mean, it is quite like, I love my wife, but if I got home and she was bathing in the blood of virgins, I might be like, we're probably done here.
Yeah, we more than have to talk, don't we? But she regrets that, but she can, that's just her nature. So you have this old woman in this sort of shabby but strange old hut in the woods, and you feel sorry for her at the same time as realizing that she's actually a monster and she was even worse in the old days. And it's quite beautifully done, really.
It's an interesting exploration of, like, because it's a thing you often see with vampires. Vampires are often in a lot of fiction now. They're these big, monstrous sort of creatures, but actually they're cursed by a need to drink human blood. And
yes,
you know, like you say, it was her nature. There's actually a degree. You know, if I had to start drinking human blood, or if my wife had to start bathing in the blood of virgins in order to sort of stay alive, well, I don't really have much of an option there, do I?
Well, that's the thing, and I think this is what he touches on quite and his language is fairly simple. He's a bit like Stephen King in the sense of it's not Shakespearean text, but you can read it quite quickly and you go with the flow and you're getting what the author's trying to tell you. And I quite like this. It's a fairly straightforward level of language in his works. But you're getting these nuances of people just did things because they wanted to. And that's, if we think about it, most motivation comes down to, well, I just want it. There's that great scene in Guardians of the Galaxy where Rocket's talking at the end of the film to the sort of police people. And he's like, well, what if I want it more than the other guy? And the guy's like, well, it's theft. He's like, but what if I want it? You know, and he's just, his whole position is, well, I see it, I want it, it's mine, which is a very like toddler kind of perspective. But most of us do that, don't we? We justify buying our, you know, if we're geeky, we buy our figurines or our pictures or, you know, our fancy dice.
I feel very judged with an entire wall of RPG books behind me, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why I haven't got video on, because I can't be, you know, you'd see the horror. You know, but we want them, so we buy them. If we fundamentally get down to it, that's what we do. And he touches on that. I mean, there's a line here from when he meets the Night Witch, and she says this. So she's now this old haggard looking woman. And she says, "Aye, look at me," she said quietly. "I was beautiful once. So beautiful men traveled hundreds of miles just to pay me compliments. Kings, emperors, heroes, I could have had my pick of any of them, but I didn't want them. It was enough that I was beautiful." "How many young girls died to keep you beautiful?" said Robert harshly. "I lost count," said the witch. "It didn't seem important then. I was young and glorious and men loved me. Nothing else mattered." And I think that's incredible. That's just, she's not apologizing for it. She's just explaining. This was the thing. It was like night and day. I have the ability to do this, and therefore I'm going to do it. And she goes on in the section about how she'd entertained the lords and the ladies. And the line at the end of the paragraph is, "They never noticed if a few peasant girls went missing from the villages. They wouldn't have cared if they had." And you read it and you sort of go, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah.
In a medieval society, you know.
I think our modern society, like, yes, I think if some, our politicians wouldn't turn a blind eye to people going missing, but people going missing in a different country, You know, you, there was a thing recently in the news about one of the there's a coal burning power plant somewhere in the north that burns wood pellets, and it gets loads of green subsidy because it's burning sustainable wood pellets, and it turns out it's just been chopping down rain like ancient forest in Canada and then turning that into wood pellets and then burning that.
Oh, Lord. Right.
But like, it's one of those things, or you know, all of our e-waste just getting dumped in the developing world, you know, like, and we're quite good at turning a blind eye to that when it's not happening to us. I'm intrigued about the comedy you mentioned, the
Yes.
sarcasm that's in the book. One of my favorite authors is Robert Crais, who writes kind of noir detective novels set in LA. But I think he does, and it's interesting because his books aren't comedy books at all, but he does self-deprecating sarcasm so well in a written form in those books. It's absolutely incredible. And I think humor, it put into something that isn't a book of humor, you know, isn't just a Shrek storyline, but has a little bit more oomph to it. I think it can add a real richness.
It absolutely can. And I also think it's very real because if you think about life, I mean, life is life is a great, it's great, better than the alternative, right? That's the old Tommy Cooper joke, I think. But if you think about it, it's hard, it's challenging. You have to make sure you get up, you go to work, you earn enough money so that you can pay all your bills. There's always more, what you have is finite, what you want is infinite. You have to make sure that you're nice to people all the time. You have to treat your spouse with respect and love and
And
all that sort of thing.
you're not even allowed to bathe in virgin's blood. I mean, it's really
I
restrictive,
know,
isn't
God,
it?
seriously, there's so few things you can do in life really that you want to. No, I want to do that in case the authorities are listening to this. But it's quite difficult, isn't it? We all have to do things. And I mean, I work for myself. I write RPG content and I create games, which I absolutely love. And you know what? It's bloody hard work. I work 65 hours a week as an average. Once a month, typically, I do 100-hour week. It's brutal. I've been doing that for 4 years, but I also love it. Yet there are certain aspects of it I can guarantee you that I don't enjoy so much, but they have to be done. So how do you get through that? You do it with a sort of a sense of it's necessary. You do it because it's the right thing to do. If you're like we could ship our products with less packing than we do, but we don't. We make sure that they're really solidly packed because that's important that things arrive in a pristine condition. And Ryan and I, when we're in the office, we have a laugh. We try and we have fun. And I think that humor is not separate from seriousness. And I think that in real life you have comedy and you make jokes to lighten the most serious moments. I've laughed at the side of deathbeds where people are dying of cancer because they've made jokes or something funny has been, has occurred, and you laugh, and it's nature's way of keeping the wheels turning, I
Yeah, I mean,
suppose.
one of my many hats is I'm a doctor, and I one of my specialties is palliative care, and
Right.
one of the things I really tend to do when I go into a home of somebody who's you know quite near the end of life is because everyone's really sad and everyone's really serious, and so I tend to come in and my opening words they don't, because I do it to different people, so they don't all know it's just one of my lines, but I tend to come in and say, well, your husband's asked me to come in because he says you're really just not doing your share of the washing up at the moment. And people laugh about that,
That's
and you
very
know,
good.
it tends to become a bit of a running joke, you know, like that, you know, we'll just sort this bit out, but you know, she probably does need to get on with the hoovering or whatever. But so these are good things about the book. Is there anything, yeah, you've already mentioned some criticism. Is there anything that you find a little bit less good about Blue Moon Rising?
Not about Blue Moon Rising, actually. It's not that it's is it a perfect book? Perfect is a difficult one. I'd like to praise one more thing about it, and that is that the characters in it, they suffer and they fail, and they there are consequences to their actions. So there's a line in it for again, it's just all of this is in the first chapter, which hopefully it gives an illustration to readers that there's quite a bit in the book. But this is Rupert's had some experiences now, and the line goes, his sleep was restless and plagued by nightmares he chose not to recall. For the first time since he was a child, Rupert was afraid of the dark. So here we have the hero of a book who is afraid of the dark. He's been psychologically damaged in the first few pages of this book, which we've also been laughing on page two about the unicorn hiding behind the tree. And yet, due to certain things that then happen in the next few pages, this man is traumatized. And that's brilliant because we don't have, you know, there's no Mary Sue characters here. Nobody is just waltzing through this like Superman. People get dirty, they get hurt, they get broken. And there's the finest death scene of any, well, I say finest, it's my favorite death scene in any book I've ever read in this book. I cry like a baby every time I get to it. It's just so brilliant. Yet I've also had tears of laughter rolling down my face as I've read this book. So you have this really yin and yang, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And I think in this book, he balances it. And one of the strengths of this book is that I believe that it was written as a singular book. There was no intention to continue it on. Now, if you buy it nowadays, it says it's part one of four. Now, I don't know about the listeners or about yourself, Chris, but to me, when I see one of four, it puts me off buying a book because I'm like, oh, you know, do I have to read all four of them? Like, yeah. I'm kind of busy. I don't get a lot of downtime. This sits on alone quite comfortably. I don't really remember the other books. I have read all of them. There's another sort of continuation that he also wrote that's actually better, I would say, the Hawk and Fisher series. Those are worth reading. There were sort of novellas he did with some characters coming off this book. But quite honestly, it can be read and enjoyed on its own, which I think is really good. And it's something of a rarity these days because there is this obsession with doing trilogies or quadrilogies or whatever science.
I think it's probably something to do with algorithms as well, that I suspect. I think, you know, if Amazon or whatever, if they can get you hooked on a title, and then it's probably an easier sell if someone enjoys book one
absolutely.
To sell them book two.
Absolutely. It's also, I mean, you might well have experienced this, but it's easier to write the second book of something than the first book because you've got the characters in your head. You know how to work with them. And there is that strange thing when you're an author that the characters do genuinely speak to you. They do, you're sort of writing them on the page and something will appear that you think, I don't know where that came from. But they're telling you it in some fashion, or you write it and you think, well, no, that's not right. That's not what they would do. And you reframe it because of that. So once you get to the second book, I can see from an author's perspective, it being easier. I've done it myself. I've got multiple books that have got, you know, second, You Ask, I Write was a book of role play game questions and answers that I did. And I immediately did it the year after I did a second volume because I was in the flow of it. I knew the format. I knew how to respond. So it does make sense to me, but it's not always a positive. The second book I read by Simon Green was called Shadows Fall. And Shadows Fall is entirely standalone. And he's kind of fitted it into his world. But again, you start at the beginning, there's a beginning, middle, and end, and it's nicely self-contained, and that's the best way to read it. So I like that. Okay, so in terms of negatives then, I think that Blue Moon Rising is pretty much perfect. It's I'm going to say if I had to go to a desert island, there's two choices of books. It would either be Lord of the Rings, or it would be Blue Moon Rising. And I think if I'm stranded on a desert island, I want a bit of a laugh. So I'm going to go with Blue Moon Rising.
I think often it's said you want something very long with very absorbent paper.
To be fair, Blue Moon Rising is about 500 pages.
Okay, so, well, there we go.
You know, it could be dual purpose there. That's sacrosanct. How would you do that to a book? Seriously, there's leaves on an island, right? Okay.
There are leaves on an island. It's true. You heard it here first.
I heard it here first. Absolutely. One of my many things is botany. All right. So Simon Green, where he falls off, unfortunately, is that. And I say this with all due respect to a man who's written far more things than I have. He's become lazy in recent years. And in several of his series, you have direct repetition of character traits, of events, of the same kind of heroic last minute, I will summon all my energy and I will achieve the impossible just because. And that's great once or twice. I love that last stand where someone just pulls it out of the bag and it's sheer determination. They just will not go down. I love that. And John Constantine's my favorite comic character, for example, because he just won't ever quit. And he also usually cheats, which I quite like. But Simon Green just does it again and again and again. And I remember when I actually found the same paragraph in two different novels describing different characters. And I remember reading it thinking, well, that's really similar. Hang on, I'm just going to go back and check that. And I found them. They were identical. And I thought, oh, that is disappointing. That is really disappointing.
Yeah, I think it is. Well, it is one of the challenges of this world that we live in. You know, we've talked about being writers and earning money, and sometimes people want, you know, I think quantity over quality is definitely a thing that is wanted sometimes. And I think so. For example, my example, and I may alienate a lot of our listeners here and yourself, but I pretty much can't stand Marvel movies. I just find the level of, and you know, I know it's not a popular, I just find the level of writing really, really basic, quite repetitive. You know, and there's so many of them are origin stories that lead to, like, because they've got the kind of shared universe vibe, it kind of always ends up leading to the same point of, and then this is how I joined this massive communal effort. So yeah, I can absolutely empathize with finding aspects of that difficult. But on the other hand, I'm also about 55 books into the Warhammer 40K Horus Heresy series.
I think that's called brainwashing. I'm sorry, I have to just tell you that. I think you're brainwashed there.
Like,
that's a lot of books.
It's crazy. It's a 60 book series. But it's telling the story of it's space opera, really, isn't it? You know, so it's telling the story of something that's happening on a million worlds. But there's definitely bits in there where it's like, yep, here's a battle with space marines being space marines and chaos space marines being chaos space marines. And I don't know, it's exactly the same paragraph as in a different book, but it's emotionally
it's very similar.
Exactly. Absolutely. The same paragraph.
And that is okay to a degree, because it's like in games, you want the game. If you enjoy the game loop, then you will go back and you'll play the game. I enjoy an Xbox game that's also on PC called Deep Rock Galactic. Now, Deep Rock Galactic's fairly simple. You are a space dwarf. You go down to a planet. You mine minerals. You shoot bugs. Rinse and repeat. That's it. There's no end game. There's no storyline beyond what I've just described. That's it. That's the whole of the game. I probably sunk 500 plus hours into that game. It's mental bubblegum. It's fun, and I can lose quite often if I jack up the difficulty to a point, you know, a certain point. But the loop is quite entertaining, and I think it's the same in literature. You can enjoy that repetitive loop, and if you're a fan of anything like wargaming, anything like comics, you have to enjoy the loop, because Batman's always going to be Batman. Wonder Woman's always going to be Wonder Woman. Yeah. Superman's always going to be, God, boring. Sorry to all the Superman fans, but he is kind of boring.
I think that's actually where games are interesting in a difference from literature. In that, I still think there's a place for I think there's a place for easy reading literature that maybe doesn't reinvent the wheel. I think that can be really nice. But I think what's great about games is it is always much more satisfying to be the hero who is pulling everything together and saving the day at the end. You know, like, as in, that gets boring a lot less than reading about a hero. You know,
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think I would say I started off wargaming as the first form of gaming that I really took on to myself to do, with old plastic war figures that my dad had painted up from the Napoleonic eras. And, you know, I put them out and I just had little pitch battles with them, and then some cowboys and Indians figures that he had. It was all mix and match. But yeah, when you can pull off that last minute save, that's fantastic. And I think you then go from that in some ways to the literature, where you then find it, and then it's a loop. You go back to the gaming and you try and experience it again. My newest game, Final Quest, you start off, the storyline is in brief that your party has been killed, you've died as well, but you're brought back by a resurrection amulet that then burns out. So you are down in the depths, you've got no weapons, no allies, no supplies, and you're only at half health, and you have to try and get out. Now, it's really hard to win. It's really hard to win. Easy to play, hard to win. But the thing is, I thoroughly enjoyed losing time and time again, because when I pull off that victory, or when I almost win, or when I defeat one big boss and then lose to the little minion afterwards, it creates that story in my head. And it's the same sort of loop each time, but it's thoroughly engaging because you can see the drama playing out. And I think that's what games give you. They give you that very visceral first-person perspective of the drama that you then get one step removed in the books.
Okay, so if you were going to, in a nutshell, explain to someone why they should hunt out Blue Moon Rising for a read, why should they?
It matches real, genuine peril, includes realistic characters that have to do heroic things and often fail, and it's damned funny. Also, it's a standalone book, and you can get it for £6 on Amazon. That's a bargain. Read it.
There you go. I mean, you can't say much fairer than that.
I think it's great. I do. I mean, I really go back to this point of, and maybe it's just a personal, clearly it's personal preference, but it's a good, solid standalone book. You know, I grew up going to the libraries and pulling books off shelves and, you know, borrowing them, going home, read a book, put it back. Sometimes there'd be another book by the same author. You get the odd series of things. You get the Enid Blyton books. You get the Famous Five. Showing my age here, I don't care.
also showing your love of cookie cutter, like we've just talked about repetition. Like.
Well, absolutely. But you know, it's all good. And also, let's face it, that's what we had back then.
even Famous Five. I mean, Secret Seven was just, you know what works? A number and some children and a dog. Like
pretty much. I like the dog. Put a dog in there, I'm a sucker for things. I mean, I think that's an interesting thing, isn't it, in literature? We could probably deep dive on that from a psychological perspective, but why are so many good stories, why do they have an animal sort of sidekick or animal around? I mean, if you think of I'm going to use the Will Smith movie version of it, but I Am Legend, the dog in there, if you take the dog out of that movie, it is not the same film, and I'm far less interested in watching it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even a talking unicorn.
It's not even a talking unicorn. No, I mean, that's even more special. So there we go. And possibly other things talk as well, but spoilers, so I'm not going to go there. I really think, Blue, if you're a fantasy fan, if you like fantasy novels, it's worth a try, Blue Moon Rising. Does it have flaws? I'm not really feeling that it does. It's not I don't think of it, you know, there's other books that I could have gone with. For example, Patrick Rothfuss, who famously has written two books of the Kingkiller Chronicle and not written the third yet. He wrote a book called The Slow Regard of Silent Things, which is a novella set within his world. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's just this emotional love story to magic and how magic actually works in a fantasy setting. A phenomenal, phenomenal read. It's quite short, and if you haven't read the other two books, it doesn't have the same impact. And because there's very little sign after sort of 12 years now of the third in what's supposed to be a trilogy coming out, I can't recommend that. Whereas you're safe with Blue Moon Rising, because if you do want to read more of the works, he's written more of those works, and if you want to read more by the same author, he's got another 30 books or so.
I mean, you do actually hit on a point. I mean, it's the reason that I stopped reading Game of Thrones, because I didn't think they were amazing, but I was quite enjoying them. And then I realized, you know, I think they're planned as part of an arc of like seven books. And he's not only has he not, I think it's been about 10 to 15 years we've been waiting for the next one, but he's just not really showing any sign of actually getting there. And he doesn't look a picture of health as a person necessarily, like as someone
you're
who,
the doctor here,
so. As someone who deals with lots of people with kind of diabetes and issues like that, he doesn't look amazingly brilliantly well. And if he's only going to bring out one book, and I think he's like 70 something, like if he's only going to bring out one book every 15 years and I'm still waiting for two more, he's got to live to 90, and I just feel he's maybe needs to go on a, you know, a few more jogs and like that sort of stuff. But so yeah, that did stop me reading that series. I'd like to raise Orcs by Stan Nichols as a potential one here. So there's some humor. It's a standalone book. It does challenge some of the stereotypes that you have in kind of fantasy. I think what I like about it is it has these orcs who are basically just a different type of human. Like they are orcs, you know, like we think of orcs, but what they are is just horrible inhuman monsters. They're just another group of sort of humanoid creatures in the book, but everyone thinks they're monsters. And like some, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a positive move. I think you have to be careful with this. You need to have villains, and you need to, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with having a race of beings that are evil. That's their inherent attitude is, we are going to kill, destroy, and eat everything. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Tyranids, great example of that. So orcs historically have been that. I think you can also have other orcs, and the way I write them, and I was writing them last night for the most recent copy of the Oracle, is I have there's an outpost that's manned by religious orcs. And it's not that they are soft and fluffy because they're religious. They're not meek. Their religion is not meek. Their religion is much more about strength and not so much domination, but just strength of action. And I think you can have both of those things. And that creates, again, for a more realistic race of characters than just pure bloodthirsty things. But you do need those. I think there's a necessity in fictional fantasy to have, whether it's zombies, whether it's if you're in the sci-fi, it's robots, something that we can slaughter and kill without feeling bad about it. Now, you mentioned Game of Thrones, and that's quite interesting, because I stopped reading the books because I'm going to say it. I didn't think they were that great. I thought they were, I can see your face on the video.
I pretty much agree. I thought they were, I read them because they got way more of my time because everyone was talking about Game of Thrones. And I was like, there's a depth here I'm missing or something. And
correct. You kept waiting for it. Yeah. But the thing that put me off it was it's brutal. It's ugly. And at the end of the day, even if the villains get killed, effectively what you're looking at is lots of people dying. And I've got to say, sometimes I'm not that comfortable with that. I don't want, you know, I wouldn't watch Saving Private Ryan for fun, because it's horrific. Now, yes, there's horrible things that happen in the world, but we're talking about my leisure entertainment here. Yeah. So in Blue Moon Rising, for example, he refers to them as demons. These are demons. They're never really more articulated than that. You just understand that they have claws, fangs, and they are very willing to kill everything. So what you have to do is make sure you kill them. And by God, there are a lot of them. So you have these wonderful siege fights, and then people are going to get overwhelmed and the barricades are falling. And I love it. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Much as you go to something in sci-fi where you've got aliens and you've got the xenomorphs, aliens, the second movie in the series, of course, there's lots of them, and we can mow them down without worrying about moral implications. Fantasy requires that, or it's very helpful to have it in your fantasy. And the Game of Thrones was too real in that respect. Of it was just horrible people being really horrible to each other. And I'm sorry, but I just checked out on that one.
I think we've done well at alienating Marvel fans, fans of book series, and Game of Thrones. So we're doing well there.
I'm just going to walk this back a minute. You said that about Marvel, not me. I'm surrounded by comic paraphernalia in this office. I'm not saying that. Although I will say that once we got to Endgame, that was the end of the whole movie franchise thing. It was like, nice, we're done. Okay, we got the Black Widow movie. Yeah, that's okay. It's fine. But everything after that was unnecessary, felt rushed, and was really subpar. And it's really disappointing. I really wish they'd just stop making the films now and just take a
I think we found shared ground there. I also wish they'd stop making the films. the thing is, though, even if you like Marvel and what they do there, there are so many amazing books out there. So many amazing books. Yes. We have so many. I don't think we've talked about Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, one of them, on this podcast. I don't think we've talked about anything else that's been made into a film. And it's like, but we've remade Spider-Man's trilogy like three times. We've done redone Batman, Superman, which you called boring, which, you know, but yeah, you know, like as in, but that's been remade multiple times as well. And it's like, anyway.
The Expanse in the sci-fi world is a fabulous example of doing a conversion into a show that it honors the legacy, you know, the original material, and both work in different ways equally well.
I hated the TV version.
Why did I agree to come on this podcast?
I didn't hate it. I love the books. I think they are, I really love the books. And I think that they started as a role play game actually as well, which really fits into like,
I love that. Yeah.
But I love the books. And one of my favorite things about the books for me, what I like about sci-fi and fantasy is you can really explore ideas that you can't explore in the real world. So one of the things they did is they had the Belters, who are the people, we are a bit off track now, feel free to skip ahead a couple of minutes if you're but it's set in space, and you've got people who live on Earth and Mars. So you've got the Dusters who live on Mars and Earthers who live on Earth, and then you've got the Belters, who are the people who've grown up in outer space, and because they've never been exposed to proper levels of gravity. And so what you have is you get these tall, gangly people with heads that are too big that literally couldn't survive on Earth because the gravity would crush them and kill them. Now, obviously, when you're making a TV show, it's quite hard to find people who've grown up outside of Earth's gravity. and they talked about the decision they had there of like, you know, they thought they could just like only cast really, really tall actors, but then it would limit their ability to have like, not that there are no good like tall actors, but it would really artificially limit them. So then what they did is they just cast any old actors, or no, good actors, but you know, people who didn't fit a visual stereotype. But the whole of the first book, it talks about it talks about the tension between these two groups to the degree that when someone walks into a room and they're visibly not a Belter, everybody, like the whole tension in the room changes. And they still did that, but without the level of visual. Like, so someone would walk into a room, and I watched it with my wife who hasn't read the books, and she was like, I don't really understand why they're annoyed. Like, as in because that wasn't there. So I never got past a few episodes because I found that so hard, because it was such a, because really the political tension between Earth, Mars, and the outer belt is the foundation. That is a character in those books.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the core of the books, and everything else, the proto molecule, etc., is a side issue, really.
I think maybe part of the issue is I have quite bad face blindness. You maybe watch them and very quickly were like, oh, this is from there and they're from there and I can see them.
I actually have the same problem. So I think for me, it was, I thought they captured it quite well because they did the accent, which I struggled with a little bit sometimes, is understanding the clipped accent that they gave the Belters. There was a limit to what they could do. I mean, there was one scene right in the first episode where you do see this sort of long, gangly person who's supposed to be a Belter. And then they never do that again. And of course, it, just for practical reasons, they couldn't. And of course, we had the rather dishy Kamina Drummer actress. I don't know her actual name, performing that character. So that wasn't a bad thing. I'm okay with the character choices. but, you know, you just have to accept that because it's sci-fi. How much could they do? Because everything else was done so beautifully, and the space battles, the way they filmed those, it's almost difficult to now watch any other science fiction. And I love Star Trek. and I kind of like Star Wars mostly sometimes.
Wow, we're going there. I also don't really like Star Wars very much. So let's move. I think let's move on because we've there is now no one left listening to the podcast who likes us.
I love Doctor Who. I love classic Doctor Who. If we can just save any author, any listeners.
It's excellent that you are able to save some listeners by the fact that you enjoy Doctor Who, and I'm not going to say what I think about Doctor Who. Anyway, moving on. I have been Chris Lowry. Usually now is where I talk about where you can find me online, but I just think I'm going to get abuse, but I'll do it anyway. So you can find me as at CM Lowry author, and you can find me at allaboutchris.org. and various publications I've been involved in, generally at Beyond Cataclysm. Stephen, where can we find out more about you?
The best place would be thegrinningfrog.com. That's the sort of central hub for everything. I'm also terrible at marketing because I'm too busy writing content. So whilst I'm on Twitter under the same handle, thegrinningfrog.com, I'm not there very often. So thegrinningfrog.com, I'm old school. I do a blog, which I've started to do a little bit more regularly. And there's a mail shot that people can sign up with, etc. I also hang out on Kickstarter a lot. And again, thegrinningfrog is the name. It can be searched and found on there. I do a campaign roughly once a month for different RPG contents or solo play game books.
Indeed. And there's I've personally really enjoyed Xylite. I think I reviewed it for Tabletop Gaming Magazine and gave it a must play, or at least a yes. I can't remember. You should email them and find out, because
that's so pretty cool. I didn't know that had happened. Excellent. I buy that magazine occasionally, but I missed that issue. Dang.
Marvelous. This has been a podcast. It's mostly been a tirade against all the things you love and hold dear. But aside from that, we've been a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. If you enjoyed this, and we've mentioned roleplay quite a few times, we have another podcast called What is Roleplay, which is a look at the basics of roleplay games, RPGs with special guests, and a beginner-friendly approach. So you don't need to know anything about roleplay games. You can just jump in and hear us, hopefully not insulting all of the things that you like. Please,
I hope there's a bit of that.
Well, obviously there's got to be a little bit of hatred, otherwise it's not what we're about. And on the mark of hatred, if you've hated this podcast, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast, because it helps us. We do lots of things at Beyond Cataclysm, but we also have a Patreon, patreon.com/ Beyond Cataclysm. And our aim is to try and sustainably pay myself and Dave, who is our in-house editor. Dave will have edited this. Hopefully he's gone through and bleeped out almost anything that we said so that no one can be offended by the podcast.
There won't be much left.
I don't think there is much left. There's like one mention of Blue Moon Rising, and that's about it. Do you have any final thoughts for us, Stephen?
I think that we've just been incredibly honest about things, and I think that it helps to do that when you enjoy these fictional worlds that are out there. There's so many choices. There's some wonderful authors, and it's all right not to like the popular things. That's what I would say. And, you know, I'd love it if people come. If anyone's listening to this and think that I'm not, you know, doesn't think I'm a complete idiot or jerk, then, you know, thegrinningfrog.com, lots of different things there. There's ways to reach me. You can drop me a contact through the website. And let's just keep gaming together.
And actually, because what Stephen does is Stephen makes games that aren't games that you've heard of, probably, unless you have heard of them. But if you haven't heard of them, the thing is, because what they aren't is Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, I know you do make some Dungeons & Dragons stuff, but you make a lot of games that aren't Dungeons & Dragons, because actually my experience of roleplay games is that the biggest, most popular one that everybody's heard of, I really don't get on with very well. Like I said, and that is fine. Like, it's okay to not love the popular thing.
I think it's actually quite difficult to go against the flow of things. I think people get caught up in what's new and what's shiny, and they also follow the biggest company, because the biggest companies have the most marketing and they can do the glitzy graphics and the nice images, and there's lots of things to like, but it's not necessarily the thing you're going to love. And with your precious spare time, do the thing you really enjoy. It's one of the reasons I've started to produce and make solo play games in different formats, whether they can fit in your pocket, whether you know use a deck of cards to play them, or whether it's a solo play role play game as it is with Starship Scavengers. You've got the choice to play it as you want. And I give guidance in the books about how you can adapt these things. And probably nobody's out, all the people who play it, and they've all been very popular, which is lovely. They probably all play it slightly differently, which is absolutely fine. There's no judgment whatsoever. And in fact, the game was designed so that when you buy, there's an optional deck of creature cards and environmental cards that you can have. You play a space character who goes around and scavenges for riches on these derelict spaceships. Well, if you buy the cards, what I recommend you do, and I've designed it so you can do this easily, is you literally get the different decks of cards, you shuffle them together, and you can just sketch out your own map of a spaceship and just do your own custom game. I'm giving you the tools and just go and have some fun. And it's unregulated by anybody. And I think that's how the games, that's how games really should be. And, you know, it's all about having fun. If you're not having fun, do something else.
Yeah, if you get halfway through a book series and you're like, I'm not enjoying this, that is fine to stop.
Absolutely. In fact, can I give you a Simon Green example of that? I know we're coming to the end of the time here, but Simon Green has a series of books called the Nightside series, which there are 9 books in the series. I have read books 1 through 8 4 different times. I have never read the last one because by the time I get to the 8th book, I've kind of had enough. It's brilliant and I love it, and there's some phenomenal ideas, but I've never ever felt compelled to read the 9th book. And because I won't read a book out of sequence, I have to read from 1 onwards. And each time I get to 8, I'm like, yeah, oof, that was fun. Okay.
I've never made it into past June book 1. June book 1 is amazing. But I've heard such various warnings that I've been too afraid to read anything else. Anyway, that is enough. We didn't criticize June. Well, I did a bit, but not really. And the films are good too. Films are good. I like the new films. Did you not like the new films?
Don't ask me that.
I do have a criticism of the new. Okay, let's do it anyway. Come on. My criticism of the new films is the whole way through June. If you haven't seen June, June is if you haven't read it, it's a desert planet. Really, really, really deserty, and water is a real issue. And there's these people, the Fremen, who their religion really is water, is the preservation of water. And then, in the books, like, water is just the most sacred thing. And then in the films, because they've got these attractive actors they're paying millions of pounds of, they don't have their masks on and they're like face kind of coverings on. And in the book, it's all the time because you are preserving the tiniest amount of air that you could breathe out with moisture in, or the tiniest bit of spit. And they can basically completely ignore it because they like having attractive people on the screen.
I see. Well, that's back to sort of the Judge Dredd films, and Carl Urban did it right by keeping the helmet on, and full marks to the man for doing an absolute bang up job on that. I'm not even going to talk about the other film. Dune, I've just come out from the cinema 2 days ago, having seen the second one, and I'm just going to use one word, which was disappointed.
Okay, interesting.
I think what people must know before they go see it is that it's very, very much a middle film. They are almost lying about, or we bring the storyline to a conclusion with this film. You absolutely don't. And for a film that tees up a final battle for about 2 hours, it's really disappointing what you finally get. At least that's how I felt.
So you have been listening to This Book I Read, also known as This Film I Disliked, or This Well-Loved Series That I Publicly Derided. It's been hosted by me, C.M. Lowry, and starring Stephen Hart. Find out more about us, our podcasts, opportunities for submissions to our projects, and more at beyondcataclysm.co.uk. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye now.